despite my best efforts to grow older. I am Muslim. I am a democratic socialist. And most damning of all, I refuse to apologize for any of this.
Zohran Mamdani speaking at his victory party on November 4th after he won the New York City mayoral race, defeating former Governor Andrew Cuomo. After his speech, Mamdani was joined on stage by his wife, Rama Duaji, and his parents, the filmmaker Mira Nair and Columbia University professor Mahmoud Mamdani. Zohran Mamdani will be sworn in on January 1st. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Carl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Ozbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Turrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hillary Clinton, Tip O'Neill, and Ronald Reagan all agreed, get tough on youthful offenders. Treat them as adults. How has that been working? Is there a change happening? Is it for the better? Stay tuned. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
It was not long ago that the momentum for prosecuting young people as adults as harshly as possible seemed unstoppable. It was the wave of the future. After all, name me a politician who doesn't want to look tough on crime. Until recently at all, America's young criminal offenders had become routinely slammed behind bars with all the toughness that could be imagined. But even in this era, when extreme cruelty has become the order of the day under President Trump 2.0, young people themselves, their parents, and even corrections personnel have started to reverse what appeared to be an unstoppable tide of cruelty without mercy. And it's not like young super predators are now suddenly free to walk the streets and terrorize innocent victims. In fact, our streets are safer than they were before the lock them up and throw away the key era. A new mentality is working. A new approach is working for youthful offenders. Maybe, just maybe, there's something from which the whole unspeakably awful mass incarceration system can learn. How did this remarkable change come about? In her sequel to her 2014 book, Burning Down the House, author Nell Bernstein's newly published In Our Future, We Are Free, The Dismantling of Youth Prison, begins and ends with the imprisoned youth who took a leading role in their own liberation. Imagine oppressed people taking their own situation in hand and successfully making real change. In her new book, our guest Nell Bernstein exposes and challenges what's been there for far too long, the racist brutality of youth prison. Most importantly, the stories she tells are replicable in the wider prison world. Communities are pursuing safety, rehabilitation, and accountability outside of locked institutions, offering a model for how we might overcome our addiction. And it most certainly isn't a destructive addiction to incarceration writ large. The fact is, in trying to make our brothers and sisters who have committed crimes invisible, America has only exacerbated the problem, as we do with so many social challenges. The author shares this remarkably encouraging story at a particularly unsettling moment and clarifies how we can have it all, safe streets and free children. Imagine, CNN host Van Jones called her book a triumphant story of how young people, parents, and their allies reclaimed a future for themselves and generations to come. And another reviewer cited the book as a hopeful testament to the power of love, resistance, and redemption in an era hungry for change. Again, the title of the new book is In Our Future, We Are Free, The Dismantling of Youth Prison. And in the long run, the bigger picture, we call into question the efficacy and effectiveness and downright sanity of the whole carceral system, which is out of control. Nell Bernstein is the author of Burning Down the House, winner of the American Bar Association's Silver Gavel Award, and All Alone in the World, a Newsweek Book of the Week. She's former Soros Justice Media Fellow, a McDowell Fellow, and winner of the White House Champion of Change Award, a different White House, obviously. Through her work coordinating the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership, Bernstein wrote a Bill of Rights for Children of Incarcerated Parents, which has been used as a template for policy reforms across the country and internationally. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Glamour, Salon, Mother Jones, and other publications. Nell Bernstein, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive, and thanks for your work.
I'm very glad to be here.
The title of your book, In Our Future, We Are Free, that must be a story as to how you came up with that title. Do tell.
Yeah, and the story is that I, in fact, didn't come up with it.
Yeah.
Those words belong to a group of young people in Richmond, Virginia, who were working with two organizations, Rise for Youth, which is an advocacy group, and a remarkable organization called Performing Statistics, which does multimedia art projects with young people. So in Richmond, these young people worked with an array of artists from multiple media to create block-long murals, or murals that rose the entire height of a skyscraper. And their mandate was to portray what a world without youth prisons looked like to them. And these were incredible. If you walk by them with your cell phone, you hear voices. They're sort of multimedia, multidimensional. But one of the most compelling murals has the words, "In our future, we are free," stretched across a block. And that stayed with me because of the pronoun we. What was so compelling to me about that is that these weren't kids imagining their own individual futures. They were imagining and working towards a collective future. Uh-huh. And that's why I chose those words as the title of the book.
And it is amazing, as you look through history and culture, the power of art to make change and to express what people are feeling. It's very powerful. The topic of this book, the prospect of closing down two-thirds of today's youth prisons, would have been unthinkable at the time of your last book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. How is it that today it's a topic of serious, widespread consideration?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very complicated question, and I don't mean to insert an ad here, but you really have to read the book to get the whole picture.
Well, that's the idea.
But I will agree with you that it was inconceivable, not just when I wrote my book, but when I began interacting with young people caught up in this system. My own introduction to these institutions came in the 1990s, which, as you mentioned, was the height of the super predator era.
Right.
And during those years, I was editing a youth newspaper in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my staff came from every corner of the Bay. And it just was not that unusual for them to get stopped by the police and sometimes arrested on their way to our downtown office. And when that would happen, you know, I would put on my little Ann Taylor suit that I had bought for the occasion and go stand next to them in court. When that didn't work, I'd go visit them in county juvenile hall. And, you know, when things really went south, I would correspond with them when they were sent to the California Youth Authority, which was then the largest network of state-run youth prisons in the country, with more than 10,000 kids in conditions that a court-ordered monitor from the time described to me as medieval. And, you know, when I was fighting for those kids in those years, the most I could imagine was maybe protecting one or two of them from going deeper into the system. It just, these places felt like mountains to me. It just didn't seem conceivable that they would disappear. So I'd love to continue talking with you about the many, many elements that converged to bring about their decline. I don't think I can quite capture it in a single answer.
Well, the idea is to have people buy and read your book. Let's face it here. I'm not subtle about that.
No, and I'm not trying to withhold. I think, you know, it took everyone. It took young people themselves, first and foremost. It took their parents. It took civil rights attorneys. It took advocates. It took legislators, neuroscientists studying the adolescent brain. So many people were involved in this change. But I think you asked me to sum it up. And
I recognize that's difficult.
No, but I have given it a lot of thought, and I've come to conclude that there are two things that sustain these appalling institutions, and those two things are dehumanization and invisibility. So to take them down, you have to counter both of those forces. And when I say invisibility, you know, I don't know if you've ever driven down a rural highway and seen, you know, a glint of razor wire in the distance, but we cite these places in the middle of nowhere partly for economic reasons, but also because we don't want the public to see them. And the walls and bars and fences and coils of razor wire that function to keep some people inside them also function to keep the rest of us out. So as a reporter, it's very difficult to get inside these public institutions. Even family members who face all kinds of obstacles when it comes to visiting, even when they do get inside, they're limited to a tightly surveilled and controlled visiting room. So what happens on the units where young people spend their days and nights is largely hidden from view. So I think the key thing that every advocate did, although they each did it from a different direction, was work to pierce that veil of invisibility and force the public to look at what we were doing. The second theme that ties all of these different advocates together is their insistence, and again, starting with the young people themselves, their insistence on their own humanity. You mentioned trying kids as adults in your introduction. That is the legal statement that some children, largely Black and brown children, just aren't even children at all. So I think, you know, we can get into conditions inside these places, which, according to the United Nations, often amount to torture. I think to do that to a child, you can't see that child as fully human. Right. You can't see that child as the same as your child. So that was the other task of every kind of advocate, was just asserting again and again that all children are children.
And adolescence has been described as driving a car with a sensitive gas pedal and bad brakes. How have these findings fueled the debate around trying youth as adults?
Right. So, you know, I think if you've ever raised a teenager been a teenager, it's sort of intuitive to you that they are prone to risk-taking, even more so when they're in a group, and generally don't think the way an adult does about the potential consequences of their actions. So we know that intuitively, but what happened over the years was that a group of developmental psychologists and psychiatrists and the neuroscientists began studying the adolescent brain, and they discovered exactly what you described. In fact, sticking with the car metaphor, one of the earliest experiments involved putting teenagers in front of a computer to play a virtual game of chicken, where they had to drive a digital car towards the digital wall. And the closer they stopped to the wall, the more points they got. Uh-huh. And what the researchers found was that if you had a kid on their own, they would accelerate towards the wall but stop a few inches short. If you put them in a group, they all crashed into the wall. So that tells you something about the influence of a peer group on the adolescent mind. And then what happened was an instrument called the fMRI, for functional magnetic resonance imaging, was invented. So an MRI can show you the adolescent brain, right? And that's how neuroscientists learned that the prefrontal cortex, which is in charge of all kinds of reasoning and that's where the brakes are, isn't fully developed until around age 25. Yeah. With the fMRI, you could see the adolescent brain in motion. So you could give it different tasks and challenges and see which parts of the brain lit up. So then we had hard evidence that, as the Supreme Court ultimately put it, children are different. And that really influenced law. A series of Supreme Court decisions known as the Miller Trilogy first determined, based on this neuroscience, that it was not acceptable to sentence children to death. So they really started at the extreme. And then there was a decision that mandated that you couldn't have a sentence of mandatory life without parole for a minor. And then finally, there was another decision that made that one retroactive. So even though these decisions only touched on the extremes mm-hmm. of adult sentencing, the extremes of punishment, as they filtered down through state courts and state legislators, they led to a real pulling back from the practice of trying youth as adults. After the super predator entered the scene, every state in the country passed some kind of law facilitating the transmogrification of children into adults for the purposes of punishment. After this body of science was popularized, that changed. And now I think 44 states have dialed back those laws. And that's really important, because when advocates began pushing for the closure of youth prisons, there was a lot of fear that if judges yes. didn't have this tough option, they would just send more kids into the adult system. It turns out the exact opposite has happened. Youth incarceration is down by 75%. Wow. The prosecution of children as adults is down by 80%. So that really tells me that not only has law and policy shifted, our perception of children really has undergone a profound shift thanks to this movement.
You cite some decisions by the Supreme Court. You're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. Boy, that was a different Supreme Court than we have now.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there was a decision a year or two ago. I think it was Jones versus Alabama, where the Supreme Court actually chipped away at those decisions. The court had originally determined that when they determined that mandatory juvenile life without parole was unacceptable, the prosecution then had the burden of proof, if they wanted to impose that sentence, to prove that a child was permanently incorrigible, you know, which involves an element of fortune telling that is fictional. So they rolled that back so that now you don't have to find a child permanently incorrigible to try them as adults. And unfortunately, that was followed by a larger backlash around this practice. Before Congress went into recess, they passed a law impacting DC youth, because that's who they have jurisdiction over, that lowered the age at which a child can be tried as an adult in DC to 14. And six or seven state legislatures in the last couple of years have passed laws either lowering the age or adding to the list of acts that can make you eligible for adult transfer. And even at the county level here in California, where I live and elsewhere, there's a number of district attorneys who are now reversing their predecessors' policies and pushing to try more kids as adults. So the big picture is still very, very positive, but we are in a moment of backlash, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, considering everything that's going on, when, you know, the ICE thugs rounding up people who look Hispanic and, you know, just treating them very badly. I mean, you talk about medieval conditions. I'm not even sure that conditions were that bad in medieval times, but the backlash, yeah. You're right, it's very significant. And I, you know, you talk about kids when they're with other kids, they do take more chances. And I wonder about being locked in prison behind bars when they're all bunched together, if that doesn't exacerbate that very problem.
Of course. And that, you know, this gives me an opportunity to mention another important statistic, which is that not only has youth incarceration dropped by 75%, so has youth crime. Youth crime is at its lowest point since we began measuring it, and yet we still have this narrative that we're all in danger. But yeah, I think we're given this false dichotomy that we can either have free children or safe streets. Mm. It turns out that's not true. We can have both. And I say that because there's a body of research showing that youth incarceration not only fails to protect public safety, it is actively criminogenic.
Yes.
So once you control for everything else, family background, gang involvement, et cetera, being incarcerated as a teenager significantly increases the chance that you will go on to break the law and be incarcerated as an adult. So not only are we not keeping ourselves safer, we're endangering ourselves through this intervention.
Yeah, it is amazing how much is done in the name of security that actually terribly worsens security. You can look at our foreign policy like that. But we're not talking about foreign policy today. We're talking about domestic policy, and that's locking kids away in jails. And our guest today is Nell Bernstein, who's got a new book just published, In Our Future, We Are Free, The Dismantling of Youth Prison. And it seems like we take some steps forward, some steps back. And I can't imagine politicians who don't want to look tough on crime. I mean, Tip O'Neill joined with Ronald Reagan in that push for being tough on crime in the 1990s. The California Youth Authority, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with, representing the largest network of youth prisons in the country, found that reports of abuse, neglect, and abject isolation were so numerous that cruelty seemed baked into the institutional culture. Tell us a bit, if you would, Nell, please, about the CYA and how it mirrored the country's mindset at the time.
I think to describe that, I'd like to tell you about a particular group of young men who were not only incarcerated in CYA facilities in the 90s, they were on disciplinary lockdown units. Uh-huh. So a sort of prison within a prison. And I was able to access their testimony because of a remarkable civil rights attorney named Sue Burrell, who fortunately, before she became an attorney, was a librarian. So young people, she had sued the youth authority over special education. And as a result of the settlement of that lawsuit, her name and address had to be posted in every one of the institutions. So because of that, she began to get letters from mm-hmm. young people on these lockdown units. And because she was a librarian before she was an attorney, she kept them. And she gave me access to this incredible archive she had kept. And the things that these young men described, being kept in their cells 23 hours a day, being handcuffed to a chair in the hallway during the hour that they were legally mandated to be allowed to exercise. Mm. They also described, if they committed an infraction or just annoyed a guard, a sort of a goon squad of guards in paramilitary garb would rush their cells, strip them naked, handcuff or sometimes hog tie them, and then beat and pepper spray them while they were restrained on the ground. And I knew about these things from young people I had come to know, and also from my reporting for Burning Down the House. But there was something about seeing these accounts in shaky handwriting, because these kids were writing with either a smuggled pencil stub or in some instances with just a shard of lead. Something about that just hit me all over again. And they also described a practice that I did not know about, and found hard to believe initially, that guards would duct tape their cells to make sure that there was no ventilation, and then throw a chemical grenade into the cell. And that was so shocking to me that I looked for corroboration, and I found it. For example, in a newspaper article, the superintendent at the time described this practice as, quote unquote, a creative solution to the problem of guards being forced to inhale toxic chemicals that had been intended for children. But the amazing thing about these letters is that these kids weren't just crying for help, they were organizing. In one of Sue's boxes, I found a manila envelope so overstuffed that it was splitting at the edges, because somehow, even in essentially solitary confinement, one young man had gathered letters from others on his unit and gotten them to his mother, who got them to Sue. And one of the letters, a kid, while trapped in a blinding chemical fog from a grenade, had written down not just the name of the grenade, but the serial number, so that, as he wrote to Sue, they can't say I made it up. Another kid had enclosed a few pages from the ward's rights handbook and numbered his concerns to correspond with the provisions that were being violated. Another young man did the same thing with the United States Constitution. And again, I talked about the pronoun we in the title of the book. So many of these letters used that pronoun. Somebody might talk about something that had happened not to him, but to a kid a couple cells down. Mm-hmm. And we need our rights respected. We need some outside help. So what that told me was that even under unbelievable conditions, these young people were organizing and advocating. And that advocacy on the part of those affected by these systems, I think, really was the origin story of this movement.
Young people advocating for themselves. It's amazing to me how much these days in Trump 2.0, there's cruelty. And it's odd to me, this psychological need for being cruel to other people, especially when they're most vulnerable. And these people are young, which means they're vulnerable. They're locked up, which means they're vulnerable. And what the process that's been going on, this medieval, ugly process, does anybody think it's going to make them better citizens?
No, I don't think anybody really. I don't think anybody on the inside thinks that.
Right.
I do think, unfortunately, for many years, legislators, the public, and the judges who were sending young people to these places didn't understand what was happening inside them. And that's why I talk about invisibility as such an important factor in sustaining these systems. I had several parent activists tell me, and this was in California and Louisiana and several other states, that, you know, they had a kid maybe with some mental health problems,
sure,
who committed a minor act of delinquency, went before a judge, and that judge would tell the parents, you know, we really can't get your kid the services that he needs here in the county, but the state has what he needs.
Oh.
And the parents believed it. They thought their young people were being sent to therapeutic institutions. And then when they went to visit, of course,
they found
prisons. Yeah, a mother in Louisiana described the first time she visited, her son lifting his shirt to show her a bruise in the shape of a guard's boot. So I do think, you know, because we talk about rehabilitation, we don't call them youth prisons. I call them that because that's what they are, but they're called ranches and academies and boys camps and all kinds of crazy euphemisms. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do think that there was a myth that these places would make young people better, and destroying that myth was part of what the movement did.
And that whole thing of invisibility, as a former legislator myself, I know that I will never forget there was one other legislator who said all these people who are behind bars, oh, they're all bad. They wouldn't be there if they weren't. And the idea is to make them invisible, to pretend the problem away. And it doesn't work. These people, you know, they have lives to live. A frequent response to the call to close the youth prisons is, okay, I get it. These places are bad. But where are we going to put these kids? There's the notion that forced relocation is the only appropriate and imaginable response to lawbreaking. Say more about that, please.
Yeah, I mean, that is so deep in our culture that I think we don't even think about it. But as you said, who came up with this idea that when a kid does something wrong, you need to forcibly remove them from their home and community and put them in a locked building with, as you said, a bunch of other young people Sure. who are also troubled? Like, we just don't question that assumption. Even people who think of themselves as solution-minded still think that we should put them somewhere, just somewhere better. There are instances where a young person is in fact truly dangerous, and that probably does need to happen. But as a friend put it to me recently, yeah, there are times when the kid needs to be sat down for a minute. Right. There are no times when that child needs to be isolated and tortured. So I don't know where we got that idea, but I think, I talk in the book about what I call smaller, closer, nicer facilities, which are progress. There is a movement to reduce the number of kids in large locked facilities and transfer them to smaller locked facilities that are meant to be therapeutic. In my experience, it is very difficult to have a therapeutic relationship with somebody who has the keys to your cell, even if that cell is, you know, as one person put it, painted periwinkle and a nice comforter. But I think, several people I talk to use the term incremental abolition, and I think that is what has happened and what needs to happen. You get rid of these large prison-like state facilities. You move kids to smaller, local, nicer facilities. And then, as Bart Lubow of the Annie E. Casey Foundation put it, at that point, you may be able to ask the question, do they need to be in a building at all? But that's kind of the next frontier.
There's a whole bunch of frontiers here. What was California's, and you're in California, what was that Proposition 21 in the year 2000? Tell us about the role youth themselves played in this community building moment and in what ways that may be replicable.
So Prop 21 was a legislative response to the super predator myth, which I'm assuming people are familiar with, but maybe you've got some younger listeners.
That's
true. Fellow John DiIulio at Princeton spliced speculative demographics to longstanding racist tropes and produced an academic argument that looming demographic changes, the youth population was going to grow and was going to become blacker and browner. He asserted that that meant the streets would soon fill with what he called super predators, these right. kind of not really human, remorseless, no respect for human life, no sense of right or wrong, that we were going to be flooded with these kids. Didn't happen. In fact, by the time he came up with this notion, youth crime had already begun to drop. But legislatures across the country, and particularly in California, reacted with these draconian laws. So Prop 21 had a number of provisions. Its main impact was to vastly increase the number of youth tried as adults. It did things like give prosecutors sole discretion to decide who would be tried as an adult. So a judge, you know, just had to do what the prosecutor determined should be done. Yeah. It added all kinds of gang enhancements, but it defined a gang as three or more young people dressed in similar attire, which, you know, that conceivably could have meant arresting entire sororities, but that's not what happened. So young people really understood intuitively that their futures were being ransomed for political gain. And I was, this was the era when I was running the youth newspaper in the heart of downtown San Francisco, and the streets just flooded with young people protesting this amendment. And they were so creative in the way they did it. They held hip hop rallies. They held parties that doubled as protests. They went after Chevron and I think it was Pacific Gas and Electric, which were the corporate sponsors of the bills, and flooded their lobbies. They attended Board of Supervisors meetings. They attended meetings of the State Board of Community Corrections. I may have that acronym wrong. And it didn't work. California passed Prop 21, but the organizing network that had grown in response to it never went away. So in the wake of the passage of Prop 21, that same group of young people were able to stop the construction of what they called a super jail in Alameda County. It would have been the largest per capita youth jail in the country. And they were able to block that. You know, so I think that's really important, that a movement is not one win after another. And yeah. I think we're at a moment right now where people feel like they're losing and are losing hope and losing the will to go on. So one thing I want this story to do is speak to this moment. You know, so many of us right now are afraid of being crushed under the boot of an authoritarian state. These were young people, these were parents who were living under that boot, and they resisted, and it didn't always work, and they persisted. And now, 30 years later, we're seeing the fruits of their labor.
Resistance and persistence does work, and talking with others, individual citizens and community groups and nonprofits and philanthropies that you worked with, they became powerful, actually central to the closure of youth prisons. And primary decision makers, elected officials, are loath to do anything risky. How did they, these groups, once they joined together and were persistent, how did they impact those generally considered the primary decision makers?
So, you know, one important factor was that youth crime was dropping steadily over this period. Uh-huh. So the scare language became harder and harder to convince.
All right, wasn't selling.
In California and then in Louisiana, young people and their allies organized under the slogan "Books, Not Bars."
Right, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, they shared data showing that California spent far more to incarcerate a child than they did to educate a child. And I think what that did was, you know, our schools used to be great out here. I went to them. And then when I was in seventh grade, Proposition 13, which was a property tax initiative.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it essentially defunded the public schools and they plummeted. So even if you didn't have a kid who was incarcerated or at risk of it, you probably had a kid who was going to a substandard public school. So by making that argument, we're investing in incarceration at the expense of education, the advocates universalized the impact of incarceration.
Uh-huh.
And I think that influenced politicians. Another thing that influenced them that was also a fiscal argument So it took a long time, but as these appalling conditions were exposed, advocates made sure that judges knew about them, because judges who sentence young people to these places very rarely visit them. And many of them were under the misapprehension that kids were getting services. So as advocates let them know that not only were kids not getting services, they were essentially being tortured, judges began to send fewer kids to the institutions. And the fewer kids there are, the higher the per capita cost is. Today, we have $1 million kids. In some places, the population has dropped so far that it costs $1 million per year to incarcerate a kid. So as that happened, politicians were able to make a fiscal argument.
Oh, sure.
In other words, they didn't have to say, these are good kids, let them out. They could just say, we can't afford this. And I think that's a more politically palatable way of approaching this.
Saving money, of course. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking with Nell Bernstein, who's written an earlier book called Burning Down the House, but a new book is In Our Future, We Are Free. And it's about youth detention and the crimes against youth that really happen in our name. Hillary Clinton did a lot of damage to the country in many different ways, in my opinion. One was the concept of super predator. Tell us about this mythical beast and what grew out of that belief.
Yeah, so I talked about it a bit. It was a fictional creature with no family, no conscience, no moral compass, no regard for human life. I've never met a kid like that, but it hit the covers of all the national news magazines.
Right.
Hillary Clinton repeated the language, and so did this other guy named Joe Biden. And you don't hear about that as much, but he also, when he was stumping for the really regressive crime bill of 1994, of which he was an architect.
Oh, yes.
Talked about young people who, you know, were so bad that unfortunately we had no choice but to lock them up for a very long time.
Right.
But I think he's a great example of how things have changed over the years. So he was using that rhetoric, advancing these draconian laws. When he became president, he appointed a woman named Liz Ryan to head the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which is the federal agency with some responsibility for youth justice and youth incarceration. Liz is one of the foremost advocates for closing youth prisons.
Oh.
She's dedicated her life to it. So the fact that she then became the nation's top juvenile justice official was pretty stunning. And she was able to get Biden to put in his draft budget not only funding for things like community-based violence prevention and alternatives to incarceration, but funding explicitly to close youth prisons and replace them with these things. So he too was influenced by a couple of decades of movement building and narrative shift.
Yeah, people on the left get frustrated when revolution doesn't happen right away. Well, it doesn't happen right away.
That's exactly right. And I think that is one of the most important messages of this book. You know, I remember Kamala Harris's slogan, "When we fight, we win." Mm-hmm. And every time I heard that, I thought, well, not always, you know, because the other guy's fighting too. And if everybody's fighting, they can't all win. I think, though, when we persist, we win.
Yes, when we persist, we win. A lot of active citizens help tell the story that this book tells. For example, Vincent Schiraldi, hope I pronounced that right, and David Muhammad. How did their out-of-the-box advocacy help recast the response to youth in the Washington, D.C. district, where Trump has said there's a lot of crime and he sent in the National Guard?
Yeah, so I'll talk about both of them because they're both fascinating.
Please. Yes.
But David is dear to my heart because when he was 16 years old, he walked into the youth newspaper that I edited. And his first article, you know, he had had his own brushes with delinquency. And his first article was about how taking an African-American history class in high school had given him a sense of his culture and history that had helped him turn his life around. And then he went to this high school called Oakland Tech. And at the time, our youth newspaper had a weekly column in the now defunct San Francisco Examiner, where I could place, you know, a story a young person had written that week. So the next week, an Examiner reporter visited Oakland Tech and wrote this kind of appalling racist article about how it was a thug's paradise where kids didn't care about their education and were determined to, you know, even if they got books because it was an under-resourced school, were determined to destroy them. And David walked into our office with a copy of that paper under his arm, sat down at an older model Macintosh, and 90 minutes later, he handed me this precisely worded response talking about the beautiful diversity at Oakland Tech and the dreams that the young people there had and the passion they had for their education. So he was actively pushing back against the super predator narrative, even as it happened. And then he went on to become a very powerful advocate, a mentor, and ultimately with Vinny, a system administrator. So Vinny was also an impassioned advocate, but through an unusual series of events, he was appointed to head Washington, D.C.'s youth correctional system. And he brought David with him as his deputy. And they decided that they were going to close Oak Hill, which was a horrific, abusive, vermin-infested facility where D.C. youth were kept. And he was one of a few people I profile who took the job of running these systems with the express intent of running them into the ground. So over the course of several years, Vinny and David and others were able not only to close Oak Hill, but to imagine and build an alternative that still exists, a place called New Beginnings, that, you know, it's still a locked facility, but it's bright and sunny and has smart boards in the classrooms. You know, there's a real effort being made there to give young people what they need.
What about concept of scared straight? We heard that a number of decades ago, that the idea of, you know, these horrific prisons for young people and even the death penalty itself would act as a deterrent to crime. What about that?
So there's not a lot of evidence for deterrence across the board, but this goes back to our conversation about the adolescent brain.
Yeah.
When a teenager commits a crime, the last thing they're thinking about is, you know, what are the sentencing guidelines if I get caught?
Right.
You know this, right? You raised a teenager.
Two.
Okay. the scared straight idea reflects a profound ignorance of how the adolescent brain works. So there's just no evidence for it.
Yeah. And what about the whole racism aspect of it? There's a quote from Kathleen Lucero, the first Latina to be appointed to the Santa Clara County Superior Court. She said, "Adolescence itself is a phase of human development that is really being offered to only some kids." What was she speaking of, and how did she model for fellow judges the way to challenge that phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've raised a couple of white teenagers myself, and I know from personal experience, and again, from a robust body of evidence, that there is really one surefire way of rehabilitating kids, and that's called growing up. That if you just essentially leave them alone, not as parents, but as a society, let the parents deal with it, let the community deal with it. Most kids simply age out of those dangerous years. But amen. I think what Judge Lucero was saying is just that the privilege of growing out of it is granted to white kids from well-resourced neighborhoods.
Yes.
Black and brown kids from poor neighborhoods have police on every block. You know, in my neighborhood, if you're on the street, you know, getting high or doing something that you're not supposed to be doing, the police will pick you up and bring you home. that doesn't happen in poor Black and brown neighborhoods.
Right.
So I've come to think, you hear this term racial disparities a lot. And one of the heartbreaking things about the transformation that has happened is that despite 30 years of reports and committees and blue ribbon commissions devoted to this question of so-called racial disparities, they've gotten worse. When I wrote Burning Down the House, a Black teenager was 3.7 times more likely to be incarcerated than a white child. Today, they're 5 times more likely to be incarcerated. In some states, they're 10 times as likely to be incarcerated. So I've come to think that racial disparities is just not a strong enough term. It sort of implies that, you know, maybe this is just a fact of nature. When in fact, you know, one study that I often cite interviewed, I don't know, thousands of American adults and found that something around 90% acknowledged having done something as an adolescent that was against the law. The majority, more than 50%, had done something that could have gotten them locked up. Most of them got away with it. And largely those were the white teenagers. So I've really come to see this not as a question of racial disparities, but a question of racial targeting. It's a system that targets Black and brown kids, and especially Black kids.
No question. When I think about some stuff that I did when I was a teenager, if I hadn't been white, my life would have been completely different just because of that one incident.
That's right. Whenever I speak to an audience, I always ask them to think about their adolescence. And there's kind of nervous laughter as every single person remembers the thing that they did.
Yeah. And how different their lives would have been had their skin been a different color.
Outrageous. Well, I hope they have that realization too.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking with Nell Bernstein, who's got a brand new book called In Our Future We Are Free, The Dismantling of the Youth Prison. We don't think of Louisiana as a particularly progressive place. For years, Louisiana's Caddo Parish had the highest incarceration rate on the planet, but when Clay Walker became juvenile court administrator there in the mid-1990s, he looked for ways to change that. What reforms did he make that brought a decline from 3,000 youth detained in 2012 to 514 just 7 years later? And how did that affect crime in the area?
Right. So Clay Walker became part of a really important initiative called the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, run by the Annie E. Casey Foundation and a man named Bart Lubow, who is one of my heroes.
Yeah, Annie E. Casey, I must say, they've done some great work, but go ahead.
They have. And, you know, while some people were trying to make change at the national or state level, I think what Bart understood is that criminal and juvenile justice really happen at the local level. So he sent himself and consultants around the country to work with counties. First of all, he worked with them to gather data on who they were incarcerating, because often they just didn't know. And when he found somebody like Clay Walker, who was sympathetic to this idea that young people should only be locked up when they truly pose a threat to the community, they worked together to come up with interventions that would reduce that, like a couple of things that Clay did. You know, you talked about, I think you talked about, in any case, everyone has heard of the school to prison pipeline.
Yes.
So kids in Caddo Parish were getting locked up for fights. So he worked with a new school superintendent to create an on-campus response so that if two kids got in a fight that day or the next day, they and their parents sat down together and worked it out. Fights went way down, arrests went way down. The other thing he noticed was that a lot of kids were coming into the system on domestic violence charges. And when he dug deeper into that, what he found was a very frustrated parent, a kid who was not getting along with their parent and probably needed to be taken out of a volatile situation until he could get some counseling in and get things worked out. The traditional response was to put that kid in jail. Instead, he started working with extended family to find other escape valves. So a million different ways of intervening before a kid ever enters a facility. The practice is known as diversion. And diversion worked in those individual hyper-local instances, but also by diverting kids at the front end, by making sure they never went to juvenile hall, because even two nights in juvenile hall, I think, doubles the chances that you will go on to be incarcerated again. So by stopping it at the very beginning, over time, that also stemmed the flow of kids into the large state-run youth prisons. And as we discussed earlier, that made it a lot easier to close them.
Well, we talk about how replicable programs, alternative programs are. New York's Close to Home initiative has bloomed into a network of community-based programs and small residential facilities that are being used as a blueprint by other states and jurisdictions looking to move away from the youth prison model. But it begs the question, what are the lines between home-like and carceral, between humane and inhumane?
Yeah, I think that goes back to this idea of incremental abolition. We talked about Vinnie Schiraldi and David Muhammad. Another remarkable system leader is Gladys Carrion, who ran the New York system also with the express intent of closing institutions. And during the course of her tenure, Gladys closed 21 or 22 upstate youth prisons, about half of New York's youth prisons. And while she was in that position, Vinnie Schiraldi had left D.C. and was the New York probation commissioner. So while she was closing prisons, he was doing everything he could to keep kids out of the system. And what they did, you know, that places like California, for example, did not do, is before they closed the prisons, they laid the groundwork for an alternative. So they passed a piece of legislation called the Close to Home Act, which to this day requires that every kid who goes through family court, which is what juvenile court is called in New York, is kept in the five bureaus of New York City. And they worked with all kinds of city agencies and nonprofits to create a continuum of care for those kids. So that might mean being at home with a mentor and some services, or at the most extreme end, the most secure facility in New York City is a brownstone that's locked. You know, and it's a little confusing because it's a brownstone. It's a lot better than a youth prison, but the kids are shackled when they go to the dentist or the doctor. There's a control room. There are literally hundreds of cameras in this building. There's a Sally port. So there's a lot of prison-like aspects to it. And even Gladys will now say, I'm very proud of Close to Home. I also see it as harm reduction, because what we've done is created an alternate system for young people of color, where they get services and supports through the probation system. Whereas white kids on the Upper East Side have the Y, they have decent schools, they have recreational programs. So she doesn't see Close to Home as the end point. She sees it as a step on a larger journey towards equity.
Incremental abolition. It's true. It makes a lot of sense. With regard to government, how do we channel resources to help families and communities raise children successfully rather than to prisons after something has failed? How can we press government? What should we do?
I mean, that's such a hard question at this moment.
I think
the things that we've talked about, diversion, community-based supports, are very important. But ultimately, if we really want to be safe, we need to be thinking about equity. We need to not have two systems, one for white kids with money, one for poor kids of color. Even if that second system is increasingly benevolent, we need to think about the redistribution of resources. This is my own private pet project, but we need to think about the fact that we fund our public schools through property taxes. And this is a very difficult moment to be having that conversation, because we're moving in the other direction with the concentration of wealth. So that is another conversation, and perhaps another book.
Are you not so worried as you once might have been, the realistic prospect of looking soft on crime?
Myself or
you?
Politicians?
Yes, you personally. Are you not worried about looking soft on crime? And what about people who ascribe to incremental?
No, I honestly, I've been the victim of youth crime. For example, I had a drunk, very troubled teenager hold a gun to my head. And I'm very cognizant of the harm that youth crime does, because the truth is the communities that have high arrest rates often also have high victimization rates.
Right.
I think we need to be much harder on youth crime and much more committed to public safety. But the first thing, if we really cared about the victims of crime, we'd get guns off the street, not kids off the street.
Yeah.
our tough on crime. I mean, imagine if we didn't have more guns than people. You know, kids would be getting into fistfights. So we are not even close to tough enough on youth crime. We just talk tough and act mean.
Fascinating. We can do it. It's going to take a lot of work, but obviously it can be done. There have been groups, initiatives, people on the inside who've seen what it's like, who normally wouldn't be expected to do anything about it, they're human. They recognize that it isn't working. And they're helping to make change as well. The book is called In Our Future, We Are Free, Dismantling of the Youth Prison. Its author is Nell Bernstein. And who is the publisher?
The New Press.
The New Press. Well, thank you so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive. And boy, we got a lot of work to do, but we need to be persistent and we'll get there. I swear we'll get there. Thank you. If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks.